Perhaps we ought to stick the boot in a bit. Oh, no, perhaps we ought to cooperate because we're all friends in the open source community. So well done, Bert and Ernie. You're doing a very good job over the Lumsaction show.
Yeah, you haven't got rapist eyebrows at all. It's all a lie. Crow, crow, crow your boat.
Gently down the Hartman.
Yes.
Good evening and welcome to season... Five, episode two of Lug Radio, in which we're talking to Greg Crow Hartman, infamous kernel developer.
Yes, indeed, and I can't remember what you were supposed to say. what are you going to say, incidentally?
We're going on a mystery tour.
That's right, we're going on a mystery tour.
I ask where our open source online office suite is going to come from and whether we actually need one.
Mini Nova.
And we talked about whether open source projects bitch too much at each other.
Indeed. Yes, I'm Stuart Langridge.
I am John O'Bacon.
I was going to say I'm A. Bradshaw, but I'm Adam Sweet.
And I'm Chris Prompt.
And this is Lug Radio.
So, pickpockers. I was reading the other day that Microsoft are preparing to release their online office suite. Adobe are preparing an online office suite. Google have already got an online office suite. Where the fuck is ours going to come from?
I think
the problem we've got now is everyone's preparing to release theirs, or it's operational now, and we don't have one. And I can't see where it's going to come from.
Yeah, because this is the problem with office suites, in the same way that OpenOffice, obviously, it came from a proprietary office suite, and then it was open source, and it's fucking huge. So it's going to take ages to build one from scratch. But could you convert something like OpenOffice very easily into a web thing?
I'd be surprised. Yeah. I mean, I can't flat out guarantee that you couldn't do it. I remember a while back someone talking about something which took a GTK application, basically ran it on the server, and then was basically a plugin for GTK which kept exporting the stuff as HTML. It was a big hack, but you wouldn't want to do it that way.
The thing is, do we even need an open office, an open source web office suite?
Well, if you're going to do a web desktop, which seems to be the kind of meme of the moment, everything must be on the web.
Yeah, but
surely that's the kind of the most obvious thing.
Is it going that way though?
Well, everybody seems to talk about it.
My thing is that...
But everyone's been talking about the era of the Linux desktop, and that hasn't happened yet.
I don't think necessarily that the whole world is going to go to a web desktop and the desktops are going to go away or anything like that, but there's some proportion of people who do, and presumably will continue to, find it convenient to use an online office suite rather than on their desktop office suite. And we have no way of catering for those people.
Yeah, to be fair, I think I would find it kind of useful to be able to log on from home and write documents and be able to log on from work and, you know, Skype off, write stuff. And,
so do you use Google Docs right now then?
I don't, no.
So you don't use it because it's non-free?
Yeah, essentially.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you not? I'd have thought you probably didn't use it because... it's not quite as good as an actual desktop office suite. That's the reason why I don't use it. I use Google Calendar, but Google Calendar is relatively limited in your interactions. You add an event, and you might update it, and you might drag it, right? Well, that's about it. But with a desktop suite, with a desktop office suite, it's very much about lots of interaction with what you're doing, and it always feels a little ropey with web applications. And that's the reason why I personally haven't used it. And I wonder whether... not wanting to get back to the whole desktop versus web thing, I wonder whether that's one of the reasons why people just aren't working on an open source equivalent, because we feel like we need to go after the desktop, because most people are using desktop office suites, and B, you can't get the same level of interaction very easily in a web browser.
No, I mean, I can kind of see that, to be honest with you, but I think there are going to be some people who are going to use it, despite the fact that it's annoying in some way. I can see people come up with more minimal documents. There being a trend, of, at least for some people, towards having a document that doesn't necessarily allow you to do all the stuff that Microsoft Word can do. But this is where the Abbey Word people have always been living. They're firm in the belief that there are a large group of people out there who will be happy with something that doesn't do all the complicated stuff that OpenOffice can do. I'm not sure they've necessarily
somewhere between Notepad and Word sort of thing.
Yeah,
90% of the people use 10% of the features.
I mean, I don't necessarily know that the Abbey Word project's faith that these people exist has been justified,
But getting back to the original question that Adam was saying, where's it coming from? I mean, are any of us aware of any office suites that have been developed for the web?
There's one called Ajax Word, I think. But this is not Ajax Wright, not Michael Robertson's thing. There's another one, but it's not a web application. It's in Java, I think. Right. So it happens to be published on the web, but it's not a web application in that sense of the term.
It's an applet.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. It happens to run in a web browser, but it's like, I mean, when you say Adobe have just brought one out, they haven't brought one out, they've just bought one. It's called Burst Word or something off of Virtual Ubiquity. Mm-hmm. They just bought Virtual Ubiquity, the company. And that's in Flash. It's not clear to me that that's necessarily a web application. It happens to be deployed in a browser.
But that depends whether... Surely if it appears in a fucking web browser, it's a web application. You can access it from the web. Whether it's done in Java, whether it's done in Flash, doesn't really matter. There's obviously technical preferences, but at the end of the day, it lives in a web browser, it works.
The question is, then, are we waiting for one of these people to basically open source, like Adobe to open source whatever they've just bought? Google to open source their thing?
That's the question. I mean, AbbeyWord, as far as I'm aware, has been developed as open source from the start. KOffice was as well.
Yeah.
But OpenOffice wasn't. It was a proprietary product that got opened. So I wonder whether if there's going to be... an open source web office suite, whether it's going to be, you know, Zoho Writer, assuming they don't just keep sitting there waiting for someone to buy them. If they decide to open source it, then we'd have one. But I'm not seeing any development effort towards creating
this. Is my thing, you see, because I'm always, every time I'm on the show and we talk about web stuff, I'm always the guy that doesn't know about it. And I it occurred to me that the whole focus at the moment is moving applications onto the web. Fedora 8 is there's a package for an online desktop which ties into Flickr and did you call it the big board thing?
Mugshot is the online application and Big Board is the little thing that lives on your desktop that talks to all of this stuff and talks to Mugshot.
And every other major player in this arena seems to be putting an office suite on the web. And I'm thinking, well, it's taken us 4 years to get to where we are now, or however long it is with OpenOffice, and I can't see what we've got at the moment that we've got moving forward towards having an online office suite.
But I'd say that, again, I don't know if it really matters, because it's like in the same way that a lot of hardware manufacturers have brought out embedded devices, you know? you know, Sony have brought out embedded devices, Sharp have, obviously Palm have done that, and various other manufacturers. So you could say from that maybe there's a theme towards people... Everyone bringing out their own devices, mm-hmm. whereas I'm still not convinced that the online office suite is actually particularly taken off. I think there's a possibility it might do in the future, but I don't think it. I can't see it happening in the near term. I think some things work very, very well on the web, and specifically things that are tied to a network, email, calendaring is a good example.
The thing,
As I was saying, I'm always the last guy on the web train, as it were. But it just occurred to me, I just thought in, what, maybe 3 years' time, everybody is going to be moving their documents onto online storage and online
applications. See, that's the thing where I think it's interesting is the idea of, you know, like things like .Mac.
Yeah.
And you know, online hard drives and things like that. I think that's a really great idea, in the fact that you want to be able to easily publish your files to the web so other people can access them, in the same way that people want to easily publish their photographs to the web. That's why Flickr's taken off, because people can see other people's photos. And then you can have that, like that thing that runs on Axe desktop where it pulls a random Flickr photo and sets it to your wallpaper. Little things like that are useful.
Web builder.
But I think the thing is that fundamentally with office stuff, you just want to access your files. You want to access. You don't necessarily need to edit the files online. You just want to access the files so you can load them into your editor.
I don't know. I mean, the other thing that it does give you is easy collaboration. The two benefits of online office suites, to my mind, are, first of all, that you don't have to be at your computer to get at it. And secondly, that it's a lot easier to collaborate, because two people can log in and edit the same document. There's no synchronization.
Yeah, but that's pretty rare now, isn't it?
I mean, will be.
I think it's pretty rare because it's hard, not because people don't want to do it.
I don't even think that many people want to. I think it's something that technical people want to do. And in terms of being able, and the other thing I'd counter with that is the argument you can access something from any computer. Most people are buying laptops now, so they can carry their computer around with them. I agree that it's an issue, but it's not necessarily. I don't think it's an issue that many people give a shit about.
I think you're right. The multi collaboration thing, though. most documents that are written in kind of businesses or kind of scientific papers or all that kind of stuff are all written by, you know,
Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that people don't collaborate on documents. I'm saying that the idea of software fundamentally allowing you to collaborate in real time, I don't think people using change tracking and all that kind of stuff. Absolutely.
I'm not suggesting that necessarily what an on-off suite enables is real-time editing. At the moment, none of them do. But it's a lot easier than I make a change, I send it to you by email, you make a change, you send it back to me by email. Yeah. But both log in, edit the same document. That's a lot more convenient. Yeah. And I think a lot of the reason that people aren't doing that too much is because up until now, it's been really fucking hard to do that.
But
what's the IRC quote about IRC's like
multiplayer notepad?
Right. I think collaborative editing of documents is quite important in most businesses. I mean, it's. But I think online office suites could be the same thing as.
Struck me actually. This is what Tim Berners-Lee was doing in the first place, wasn't it? The original browser was written to be able to collaboratively edit documents.
Absolutely, it was.
Yeah. I was going to say, online collaboration and office suites are going to be the same thing for wikis that fucking chat rooms did to IRC and so on.
The interesting thing about it, I think, is that at the moment, Google with Google Docs, Adobe with the new thing, Zoho Writer, none of them are trying to solve the deployment problem. As far as they're concerned, it's already solved. We've got the servers, you come to them. Whereas if we're going to enable collaboration, I don't think my firm, I mean, I work for a law firm, yes, but I don't think a lot of firms would be happy to collaborate on their documents on someone else's servers. So they're going to want a version of Google Docs or whatever that you can install in their firm. And Google aren't going to solve that problem because they don't want lots of versions of Google Docs. They want the version and you come to it.
Not necessarily.
Well, they might decide to think about it as a separate product. But an open source one, almost by definition, you have to think about that kind of thing because the idea is that people are going to take it and install it themselves. So you've got to... So an online, an open source one stands a chance of getting into that kind of environment more than one which is basically designed so there's only one server. Docs.google.com.
Is this where they're going to come from? Sorry, like kind of basically wikis growing up. We've talked about creating one from scratch or somebody open sourcing their proprietary version. But maybe just like MediaWiki will become eventually, people keep working on it, keep adding new features, and eventually it is a word processor.
I think that, again, the thing where it always falls down is in terms of the web stuff is that fundamentally the web doesn't offer as rich a user interface in terms of that kind of complex editing. As a desktop application, the only way you can achieve that really is through using something like Flash or Java, but then it's not deemed a proper web application.
Yeah, because it's essentially a desktop application that happens to appear in a web browser frame.
But who cares? As long as it's accessible from a web browser.
The point about
no one actually cares other than web developers.
blind people care quite a bit because there's lots of work got into making HTML accessible.
Yeah, and that it's accessibility in Flash.
That's not necessarily. Yeah, but if you build an HTML application, it's pretty much automatically accessible. Java's not like that. Flash isn't like
that. My point, though, is that you're basically being snobbish towards Java and Flash because it's not HTML.
Well, the thing is they also cut people out of the market that can't run those browser plugins.
You are in a position... The whole point about HTML is it's consumable by everything relatively easily. That's not the case if you're just deploying a blank box and then something, code somewhere, draws in that box.
I'm talking about from the perspective of a user who wants to use that software. They don't give a shit. And the argument of, you want it to be deployable in places, the vast majority of web browsers in the world run Java and run Flash.
Yeah, but that's not the point, right? Adobe's thing, the thing they've just bought, Buzzroom, or whatever it's called, the virtual ubiquity.
Isn't that a town in Iraq?
It's still, that's Basra. Okay. It's still, although it's in Flash, it still talks to the one central server. You can't put it in your office and have all your people use it, unless they're prepared to talk to docs.adobe.com or whatever it will be called.
Right.
So the point here is that if someone's going to build an open source one, they're obviously doing it with the intention that someone will take it and deploy it themselves. So they have to at least think about
I don't even know if that's an issue for most businesses. I don't think it's that an issue for most businesses. The idea that they get a bit paranoid about the fact that they can't deploy their own version in their own on their own intranet.
I think a lot of businesses,
some businesses absolutely. But if that was a real issue, then Salesforce would have got nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, some of the stuff is okay, absolutely, but.
I mean, Salesforce contains pretty much as confident as information as you're going to want to have in many situations.
Yeah. And if that's
been used by big fucking firms, I can't imagine.
Oh, absolutely. It is, you know. And a lot of firms don't have a problem with it. In the same way that Google Apps for your domain has taken off to some extent. You know, people are using these things. But there are going to be some firms who would rather have an internal version.
The thing is, though, is...
And they can't get an internal version of Google Docs because it's all built that... It talks to docs.google.com.
Just one last thing, just getting back to the original question as well. One question for you all, right? Which I'm uncertain of the answer of. With the free software world, software development crops up in different places. You know, people write desktop applications. People write server-type software, right? But there just doesn't seem to be the same level of enthusiasm about writing desktop software for the web. You know, in the same way that... You know, you can get little things like you can get gallery, PHP gallery, and you can get some kind of things that are relevant to what you do on a desktop. But this kind of productivity application that runs in a web browser, with the exception of a CMS, there doesn't seem to be an awful lot of this kind of development going on. I mean, why do we think that is?
Just it's fundamentally boring.
Yeah, but I mean,
productivity application, just the word productivity application.
Don't make me threaten you with my paper library example. You
well,
know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one guy can do his paper library. It takes more than one guy to do a...
I read an article today, right, about someone getting really, really exciting about this new form of buffering in the kernel, right? And I was thinking, that's the most boring thing I've ever read in my entire life, okay? Is the fact that it's boring really an issue?
Go on.
No, after you, all I was going to say is it's already been established that SNMP gives me a boner.
True, you're that excited.
Isn't that a kid's TV show with loads of bands on it?
To be honest with you...
SNMP gives me a boner.
Oh, no, that's CDUK, sorry.
To be honest with you, the reason I think it is that people building web applications are inclined to think of them in terms of this runs on my... For something complicated like that, it's this runs on my server and everyone comes to me and then I get advertising revenue or whatever. And at that point, you think, well, they're inclined to think, well, why should I release it as open source? There's not going to be a second copy of it anyway. Everyone comes here to it. So there's not the motive to release it as open source because it's only ever meant to be one copy in all the world.
Yeah,
Launchpad.
Yeah, but I'm talking about...
As a perfect example.
I'm talking about open source developers who write free software that you can deploy on your own.
But
PHP Gallery and like Moodle and like that kind of stuff.
Oh, right. So yeah, Squirrel Mail. Or
yeah,
whatever.
I mean, why isn't there more development going into this? There must be a reason.
Office Suite's really fucking hard.
Well,
Office Suite, but a word processor.
From my distant point of view, coming as a completely not a web guy whatsoever, it just seems so inherently fiddly to write such a detailed web application.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point is, if you're writing a word processor, until you've got 80% of the way there, it's useless.
Yeah,
that's true.
Unless you're prepared to say, we don't mind having a word processor, which is the target is not to be just like Microsoft Word, at which point Chris's point that that's essentially what MediaWiki is not a bad point.
Okay, on the show now we've got Greg Crowe Hartman. How are you doing, Greg?
Very good, thank you for having me.
Well, welcome to the show. You are obviously a well-respected and well-revered member of the kernel community, and unusually you don't have a very large beard. What's the reason for that?
I don't know, sorry.
There's no specific...
I'm not English, maybe that's why.
That was a dig at Alan Cox.
That was a dig at Alan Cox. Okay, although Alan Cox would probably claim he's Welsh now, even though he was born around here. So, so first of all, I mean, the kernel's a pretty big project, and the plan there seems to be to have a device driver for each different device that's in the world. Is this not going to balloon the kernel into... the world's largest code base? Is the plan to basically have inbuilt support in the kernel for every device out there in the market?
Yes, it is. We already support more devices than any other operating system today in the world.
Right.
So it's not a big deal.
Okay. I mean, doesn't it seem like there'll just be millions and millions of modules shipped with every Linux distribution? Or is the idea that you ship the common ones with it, and then if someone wants support for another device, they just compile it?
No, you ship all the modules with all the distro. It's not a problem. It's not a runtime problem. They don't take up very much space on your disk, especially with the increased size of disks these days. And it's really not a problem. There's just so many advantages to doing it this way. It is not a good idea to do it any other way.
Right.
Okay, no, fair play. I mean, to go on then, at least some of the reason now why there are more kernel drivers is because of the kernel driver project, which I understand you're now on full time.
Yes, I am.
Do you want to talk a little bit about how that came about? I understand it was a joke originally, and now it's your job.
Yes.
Fair play. I wish I could do that.
it was a joke in a way that we were trying to show that Linux can support, or all the drivers can be written for free by the community, and they have been for years. It wasn't a joke in the fact that we had something new this time. We have the ability to sign an NDA with a company and do that properly, which we hadn't had in the past, so that was something that was new. But other than that, it was just a way to show that the Linux community can handle all these things for companies that have no other reason why they shouldn't have a Linux driver.
Okay.
And it just grew from there.
How many takers have you had for that? I mean, how many
companies?
Yeah.
We have had about 10 or 12 companies take advantage of it so far.
Right, and you...
The bad thing is I just didn't have enough time to work on it full time because I had a real full-time job and a hobby. So now I can work on it full time.
Excellent.
I mean, you accept these... essentially, the idea is that companies can put forward their specs under an NDA, and you'll develop the... under an NDA or any other sort of way they want to do this, basically. How many of those companies have put out their specs to the open source community as a whole, and how many of them have demanded NDAs?
Have demanded an NDA so far. It is a very good way to talk to the company and get your foot in the door. Most all the drivers we've written so far, they've had a Linux driver that was outside the tree, or they had a Windows driver, and we just converted it. So we really, and a few specs we have gotten already, but the majority is we already had working code to start with.
Okay.
Hi, Greg. I noticed that you're a kernel subsystem maintainer for quite a lot of different subsystems, USB, PCI, SysFS, and so on. So obviously you've got quite a broad overview. I wondered if there were any particular areas of the kernel that are really actually lacking in device drivers.
Absolutely lacking.
Are there any areas where we there are lots of devices that really could do with being supported?
We can always use more wireless drivers. We're lagging a little bit behind there, but a lot of people have been picking up the slack already. Some embedded devices we're lacking, and that's what we're seeing a lot of companies ask for. And data acquisition devices, actually. There's a lot of those coming out of the woodwork right now. And that's about it. But for the mainstream, your typical desktop PC or even servers, we're very well covered.
In terms of the kernel and how the kernel's grown, I mean, obviously it's grown a huge amount over the years, and there's a lot of people working on it. And a kernel is a very, very low level, you know, piece of software for someone to develop.
It's
pretty much as low as you can get. Is it? I mean, how much of a wizard do you need to be to get involved in kernel development? I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say that you are not a very stupid guy. I think it's safe to say you're fairly intelligent, and you probably beat all of us at Trivial Pursuit. But how clever, I mean, how talented and how technical does someone really need to be to actually have a chance of writing something that's going to get into the Linux kernel?
Well, let me give you an example. Last year, there was 2,863 different contributors to the Linux kernel. So we try and make it as easy as possible for you to contribute. You just have to know how to program in the C language, and we offer up the rules and how to make a patch, how to submit them, what the proper procedures are, and you can go from there. So the fact that our pure number of different contributors to the kernel is increasing every year for the past, since the project has started, I don't think it is that high of a bar, but you just at least have to know how to program somewhere.
Would you say that compared to other kernels for other operating systems, that the Linux kernel is any easier or more difficult to code for?
I would say it's easier because all our code is out there in the open compared to a lot of other operating systems where you can't.
Well, yeah, no, I can see that.
We also try and make it very easy for you to contribute. We want to make it as easy as possible for you to add that one patch, that one change that you really need. So I really can't compare that to other operating systems.
Yeah, no, fair play. One other very brief thing. We talked about NDAs slightly earlier. I understand a few people have complained because although we're getting source out, and that's frankly what I care about, we're not getting specs out into the community, which makes it difficult for, you know, the BSDs to support these devices. Do you talk to people and try and persuade them to release their specs without NDAs, or are you just happy for however they bring things to you because it brings more drivers to Linux?
I am happy for however they bring things to us. If you look at the majority of how Linux and other operating systems respect the device drivers are written in the first place, they're done by the companies themselves under the NDAs, and you don't see the open specs as it is. So this isn't something new. It's not something else. And as far as the BSDs are concerned, I'm not telling them how to run their projects, so where do they get off trying to tell us how to run ours?
Fair play.
Just as a final question, then, I wondered if you had any comments on Linus's attempts to drop the SCSI subsystem.
Linus was doing what to the SCSI subsystem?
Linus threatened to drop the SCSI subsystem. Have you any comments on this?
Did that happen recently? I'm not aware of that, I'm sorry. I've been traveling for the past few days.
Is this an outrageous Lug Radio lie?
No, he actually did, but he was lying at the time, yeah. It's an outrageous Linus lie. So.
I thought, what? No.
Sorry. Okay. I'm sorry, I really
He said it to
know.
James Bottomley, who's the SCSI subsystem maintainer.
Okay, there's lots of problems at times with maintainers not sending their patches in the proper way, so he threatened to not pull from us at times.
Don't worry, it was a joke.
Okay. I'm sorry. I missed.
Anyway, right, well, thank you very much for your comments, and...
Yep.
Great.
Thank you very much. What else can I say? It was really a pleasure talking to you.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks. Bye.
Well, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
About 2 weeks ago, actually, there's a bloke called Ian Holmes, who's a GNOME guy, and he did a review of KDE 4. Right.
Review is a bit of a liberal term, there, isn't it?
Okay, he repeatedly stuck the boot into KDE4 before we went. Much as I shouldn't laugh about this kind of thing, he said I couldn't work out how to make KDE4 do a screenshot, so I've drawn this screenshot instead, and
it looked like one of your child's pictures.
It looked like Windows RG.
Windows RG.
That flash thing. Anyway, right. Following on from that, there was a chap called Sebastian Kugler, I think, who was on Planet Ubuntu, who basically said, I don't think people should do this. I think, you know, as free software people, we're all part of the same community, we're all working together, we should be concentrating our bile on the actual enemy, who are, you know, I don't know, Microsoft or Apple or Adobe or whatever.
Yeah,
it's not other free software projects. Mm-hmm. And what I'm interested in is... I'm in two minds about this. Because first of all, I can absolutely see his point. I've said before that I think Linux distributors shouldn't class other Linux distributors as competition. They should be classing Windows as competition and cooperating with other Linux distributions. But on the other hand, it had a little edge of, I think we should get a free pass just because we're free software too, that, you know, we shouldn't bollock people. We shouldn't call someone out for doing something that we think's wrong. Just because they're free software, and everyone gets a get-out-of-jail-free card where they can say, well, yeah, our project's bollocks, but, you know, doesn't matter. You're not allowed to say that because we're free software.
I don't know. I mean, I'm being
a deliberately unfair characterisation there, but I think there's a lot of it.
I think the thing is, I mean, yeah, in a perfect world, everybody would be nice to each other, and people would be very constructively critical. I think the thing that Sebastian probably didn't like about Ian Holmes, well, his blog entry, rather. Yeah. Maybe not about him, I don't know. He does come out with some stuff, though, sometimes, to be honest. He's very funny. He's very wrong a lot of the time, but he's very funny. But anyway, the thing about Ian Holmes is that I think Sebastian didn't take his blog entry as particularly constructive criticism when you draw a screenshot.
I mean, was it
clearly satire. Was it
intended as humour?
Well, I think so.
I don't know. Just saying this is shit.
The thing I don't understand about Ian Holmes, right, is he comes out with a lot of satirical stuff on his... on his blog. I nearly said pig then. he comes out with a lot of stuff on his blog. And sometimes you don't quite know whether he's actually ripping in someone or whether it's satire. Because to be fair to the guy, he's really funny. I mean, he comes out with some funny shit. And I read the blog entry that Axe referring to, and I absolutely pissed myself laughing when I read it. But I think that it's difficult at times to know whether there's, you know, some sort of lead laced in there.
I think there is real benefit in cross-project criticism. In so much as perhaps it opens up things that people haven't thought of, or exposes faults that people haven't realised, perhaps. But it was obviously going to be quite damaging if it's just laying the boot in for the sake of laying the boot in. Not that we ever do that here, of course.
I was about to say, I was thinking, maybe we should be aware of ourselves at this point.
Get into trouble.
Obviously, I haven't seen this blog post, but obviously, to me, it sounds like comedy gold. and that's always good value for money. But
the thing is, as well as, I mean, the open source, I think, it's. I suppose it's like, you know, the open source community is full of amazing people. You know, it's full of very inspirational people who do really good stuff, right? But then you also get trolls. And then you get clear trolls, people who are just being mean for the sake of being mean. And then you get some people who are being satirical. And I'd say that, you know, we're relatively satirical in this regard. Obviously, people like John Leach with Everybody Loves Eric Raymond is satirical. It's not intended to be mean. But sometimes, every so often, something will happen and some people will think, actually, that's quite mean. That's not so much taking the piss or joking. That's mean. And I think what happened in that particular scenario was that Sebastian interpreted Ian's blog has been a bit mean. I don't know whether Ian did intend it to be mean or not. I mean, I don't know the guy. He seems like a nice chap, and it seems like he likes writing satirical blog comments. I just don't know.
But I do love the fact that there's been kind of like, for months now, there's been this kind of, the OpenBSD developers and the Linux kernel wireless developers have been having sort of hissy fits at each other all about all of this. And suddenly, when it's his project that they'd slagged off, he suddenly decides it's a really bad thing. No one comments on it when it's,
Maybe he's kind of like, this is, you got the feeling from his blog entry that it was a thing that had been building up in his head. And I mean, something that Ack and I have these, you know, like 4-hour discussions every so often.
Yes, you do. It's called Look Radio.
Thank you.
And fuck you, incidentally, new boy.
Fuck you, Adam.
But yeah, we have these long conversations, and something that we've often discussed is the idea that the Linux community can sometimes feel like it's imploding. And the fact that there are some people in the Linux community who are killing it, and they're not necessarily intentionally killing it, but the fact that they go on so much, and I'm by no means saying that Sebastian or Ian are including this, because I don't think they are, but some other people can be pretty harsh at times, and it can really knock the wind out of people out of contributors.
I think it's pretty hard not to take a real piss take out of your project, not to take it personally and not to take it badly.
Yeah, no matter how it's meant. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to me, there are like two or three angles, really. I mean, perhaps, first of all, that, what's his name? Ian Holmes.
Ian Holmes is,
as I said, I haven't seen it, is perhaps he's exposing something that maybe the KDE developers haven't thought of. Also, I guess the KDE guys probably take it quite badly.
Coming from a GNOME developer. Yeah.
But also, to me, there's truth to be exposed there, and it obviously sounds pretty funny to me.
I think the thing is, as well, one thing I've noticed in the last sort of year or so, particularly, maybe a little bit longer, is that there's certain people in the community that a lot of people rat on, and I'd say a good example of that is Miguel. You know, Miguel's got a lot of shit recently, and Stallman's another good example, and Eric Raymond's another good example, and Bruce Perrins, and there's various people who get a lot of shit for various reasons. And I think the thing is that, you know, some people can just take it. Some people can just take a kick in the spuds repeatedly over and over and over again, and it doesn't faze them. Whereas I think most people, we're all human. We're all, you know, we've all got blood pumping through our veins. And if they take a bit of a beating repeatedly, it will knock them down. And I know personally of people who've spoke to me privately, fairly prominent open source developers who've just said to me, I'm fucking sick of the community. It's just, it drives me insane, you know, because there's too much criticism, there's too much slagging, there's too many people who are too hardcore about stuff, you know? And I know open source developers who are really talented developers who've done really great work, and these people have been involved in the KDE project and the GNOME project and various other projects. And when you start hearing people like that who you think of as being like the bread and butter of the Linux world, when you hear about them feeling demotivated because of some stuff, you know. And again, I'm not in any way citing Ian or Sebastian here. It concerns me.
There's a lot of rabid introspection, isn't there?
I mean, take Mono as an example, right? It's a project that, whether you agree with the principle of what they're doing, like they're committed, they're free software people, and they work really hard on it. And people have beaten the crap out of it repeatedly, other people in the free software
just
community.
Just a little, yeah.
And it's essentially unfair that they're doing it, especially given what it's named after.
I thought it was just a random name. What's it named after?
What? You were there in the sound chat last week, weren't you?
No. Making the tea, tea boy?
Oh!
Right. Basically, Mono's called Mono because it's a joke, and Nat Friedman's only got one bollock.
Beard.
It's true. Well, like, when we were sound checking, right, with Miguel, he said that when they were at Zimian, there was this kind of. There was obviously lots of in jokes there, you know, and apparently it's kind of well known that Nat had one spud, and therefore he named Mono Mono.
Seriously?
Yeah. It's essentially a little Zimian in joke, where now the name's known all over the world.
I'll tell you one other little thing. I think we should cut this out.
Yeah. Anyway, right, so, where was I? Yes,
Mono.
Mono, as an example. A lot of people have hit the project really hard, and be honest with you, in the past I've been one of them, and I'm still not a huge fan of the project, but should we spend less time hammering on people doing free software work and more time trying to, you know, actually beat the enemy?
I don't really think we should. I think there is a lot of time and effort expended in just kicking things for just hearing sound of their own voice as much as anything.
But a lot of it's...
Whereas if people kind of sat down and went, I think you're wrong and here's why.
It's got to be constructive, hasn't it?
Yeah, constructive criticism, fair enough.
It's like bug reporting. I mean, a bug report that's a whinge is not useful, but a bug report that's got useful information is fixable.
I think there's a lot of signs of health and vitality in the kind of in this kind of extrapolation. Is that the word I'm looking for? Yeah. Extrapolation of these ideas. But I think the danger is if you end up just shit-kicking everybody, then people are just going to either stop listening to you or they're going to just get pissed off.
I think people need to understand how this looks to the outside world as well. Kind of like if you are a Microsoft person and you look and say, oh, look, the free software community, they're kicking each other in again.
Yeah. This actually
Why should I be, you know?
I was going to raise that relates to the point I was about to raise, which is I wonder how battle-hardened we should expect our development community to be. So, for example... You know, so if we take the business world, for example, in the business world, there's a certain amount of, you've got to be cutthroat to a certain degree to survive in the high-flying business world, right? Mm-hmm. And different kinds of industries have different kinds of level of, you know, of how thick-skinned you've got to be. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how thick-skinned the average open-source developer needs to be as compared to the average Mac developer or the average Windows developer. Well, I mean, because there's this whole crusade and there's this whole ethic behind free software, whereas there isn't necessarily in the Windows
world. The thing is, with free software developers are exposed to the elements, as it were.
Mm. Yeah.
And whereas proprietary software developers never see the light of day as far as normal people are concerned.
It's not that they don't necessarily see the light of day. I imagine if I was a programmer on the Outlook team, for example, I'd be pretty sick of all the shit that gets thrown at me. But the point is, you don't get to engage in that dialogue. You have to just say, well, yeah, I can read about this stuff, but I don't get to respond, so I might as well just ignore it. Whereas free software people will read the criticism of their project, and then, because they're able to respond, they will do so. I imagine the Outlook people would like to wade into some of these discussions and go, that's not Outlook's fault, that's because you've set up your mappy stuff wrong, you're a moron.
To some extent, the developers have to be able to stand up and say, yeah, I made that decision because... You know, defend their position. Yeah, my software works like that because I thought it was a good idea.
I think other thing is, and in defense of Ian, and in defense of people like John Stewart from The Daily Show, and in defense of other people who are satirical about something, satire can be the best way of finding people's flaws, you know? Take John Leach as an example. You know, I mean, he's very satirical with Everybody Loves Eric Raymond. And it's amazing what things satire can uncover in different places. I mean, like, I'm a big fan of The Daily Show, and it's amazing what that uncovers in politics, you know? Mm. But again, it's got to be... I suppose it's balance, you know?
Yeah. I think the thing is, it's a sign of health, really, that we've got these discussions going on in the first place.
Yeah,
But I guess you have to be careful as to what you crush
your criticisms, because people's faith in their projects can only stretch so far if you're just going to keep shitting in their plates all the time.
Yeah. You have to accept the fact that other people have other point of views as well. You know, like as I was saying, the kernel argument. You know, some people believe GPL, some people believe BSD, and they don't argue about it. And, you know, but you have to accept that other people don't believe what you believe and don't think the way you think.
I think earlier on when I said about these developers I know who've become frustrated with the community, I think one of the things that the correlation there is that the primary frustration is that some people in the open source community can't see somebody else's perspective. Very, very obsessive, because there's some people in the community who are very, very hardcore about stuff, and they can't see another perspective. And that other perspective might be, yeah, I do run non-free software. Or that other perspective is, yeah, I prefer this free software license to this free software license. You know, it depends on what it is.
Since the dawn of time, man has quested for the truth. From the mountain fastnesses of Tibet to beyond the solar system itself, mankind has dreamed of windows that wobble. With tools of flint, ancient men drew the names of their gods. A futile attempt to comprehend the visions from above. They built the pyramids. They stared at the stars. With understanding, they even reckoned the number of the beast. For it is a human number. But 'twas all to no avail. True serenity lay not without, but within. They turned their thoughts to the most important question of all. Where the fuck is Enlightenment?
Yeah, you remember Enlightenment, right?
Vaguely.
Window Manager. from a long time ago, which looked really promising and then went dark for a decade.
Yes.
Yes. Well, it's still around.
I believe it. I believe so.
Yes. It is actually still around. They've been working on DR17, they call it, the next release.
Yeah.
Now, since about 1998.
Yes.
Or something.
It's, yeah.
And
it's got such have they got real transparency? It's like, I want to look at that window and actually see through the back of my monitor and see the wall.
You would think so after the amount of effort and time they've put into it. But no, I mean, I've actually played with Enlightenment recently, can you believe it? Because I wondered where the fuck it was.
Does it work? Is it finished?
Well, that's the thing. It depends on your point of view, really.
So no.
It doesn't seem to have moved on very much from how it looked a long time ago, really.
So, for someone who hasn't... I don't think I've ever used Enlightenment, actually. Tell me briefly what its overriding goals are.
It's a... it's a window manager with ultra-blingy stuff, essentially, what it boils down to.
It's not for performance, or it's not for kind of light, low footprint, small footprint environment.
I'd say it's kind of like... You know, like... GNOME is a general desktop environment, and the primary aim there is for it to be easy to use and contemporary, I think is the best way of describing it.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas Enlightenment, certainly my perspective of it before I saw Axe demo, when Axe compiled it all up and spent a couple of evenings on it, is that Enlightenment is basically designed to be really lightningly quick. Lightningly quick? Is that a word?
No.
Fucking quick, right? And it's got to be quick, but also providing lots of blinks. It's not like XFCE, which is quick because there's basically nothing there.
Yeah, I mean, the idea behind it was that Rasterman, the guy who does it, there's a team, but he's kind of the lead guy. Yeah. It's his concept.
He had an Enlightenment, and then he got high.
Yeah, he was going to release a window manager, but then he got high. Now it's 10 years later.
My oh my. Then he got high. High West.
Anyway.
In joke.
Back to the main point. Rastaman firmly believes that you could have all the bling without it being really heavy in order to make it happen.
It's like eating donuts without putting weight on.
And to some extent, Enlightenment was the original window manager for GNOME. When GNOME was first released, they used Enlightenment as the window manager. And they used Enlightenment's image libraries, IMLib, for years and years and years in GNOME until they eventually replaced it with GDK PixBuff or whatever. And I think they're really, really good at things like image rendering and stuff. If you look at Enlightenment now, you've got things like animated backgrounds. So the background I had on there is kind of a picture of a skyscape. And over 5 or 10 minutes, it gradually darkens from day to night and then comes back up to day again. You think, that's quite cool.
And it is completely pointless.
Well, yeah. Okay, but if you've got a desktop where the goal is to make it look cool,
then
things that look cool are not pointless in light of that goal.
When Ak demoed it to me the other night, the thing that struck both of us, I mean, was the fact that there's lots of nice little flourishes in there. Mm. Lots of nice little details that they seem to have done really well. You get the impression that if they took the ability of the GNOME team to build a easy-to-use environment that just feels comfortable to use, and then they combine that with the expertise of the graphics programming behind the Enlightenment team, you'd basically have the desktop environment that we all want, something that's really easy to use, sleek, and sexy.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about it, really, they've got things like a file manager in there, which is awful. I mean, I don't want to, since we've talked about not ragging on projects, I don't want to rag too much on the people who are building E-File Man or whatever it's called, but it's ghastly. So presumably people who are actually using Enlightenment full time don't use it. They'll use Thunar, say, or they'll use Nautilus or something like that. But if you do that, then you don't get all the ultra blingy stuff, because all the ultra blingy stuff comes about because they're using ETK as the widget set, the Enlightenment widget set, the Enlightenment toolkit. And people aren't writing applications in that. If you look at the applications that you get, I checked out the whole of Enlightenment CVS and compiled it, which was a silly mistake because some of the things just don't compile. And you go into the RC channel and say, I can't get this to compile, and they say, yeah, that's because it doesn't compile at the moment. Don't worry about it. And you think, well, okay.
It's because it needs lib magic.
That's real.
Is it?
Yeah, there really is a lib magic.
The image magic thing.
No. Lib magic with a K. Lib magic without a K is how, you know, you type file something and it tells you what type of file it is. That uses lib magic.
You, my friend.
I'm sorry.
You, my friend, are a fucking gimp.
Tiny bit.
The friends with the paper sizes guy.
Yes.
Interesting. Anyway, yeah. The point is that
derision from the suite.
Sorry.
Yeah.
If you look at the applications that are part of Enlightenment CVS, there's a lot of things to view images, you know, like Eye of GNOME,
right,
or whatever the KDE one is. But there are, you know, but the file manager's really underdeveloped and so on and so forth.
I mean, in preparation for doing this segment, I had a quick look at Enlightenment because I always wrote it off as one of those million
weird little things.
Well, million window managers like fucking Fluxbox and IceWM and all those light footprint window managers. And it does look great, but I did notice that the screenshots I was looking at, which were the most recent on Rastaman's website, were from August 2005, which is fucking two years ago.
Are more recent things. Some people have put YouTube videos up. But the interesting thing, if you look at the YouTube videos, is it's people saying, look what happens when I bring the menus up. And look at my desk, look at my background gradually animating through something. And look at my animated button themes and stuff. And that's all quite cool. But no one's actually got a video of saying, look at me doing my job, but this, using an Enlightenment.
It must actually work. You're kind of ragging on it quite hard, but it must actually work, because it is the default window manager with Yellow Dog for the PS3, for example.
Is Enlightenment? It? Really?
Yeah.
Lord,
a beta version of E17.
It depends on... Well, yeah. I mean, bear in mind that I was compiling CVS Head.
Am I allowed to stop thinking out loud, everybody in the House of Love?
I was just trying to think of an E17 song and then nothing.
DR17. I'm amazed it's the default manager.
Yeah,
because it's
lightweight and kind of blingy.
Yeah, bear in mind that I was running the latest version out of CVS. So it's not surprising that it was a bit crashy in places. I had it segfault on me a few times while I was using it. and I wasn't doing anything very exciting. I mean, the big problem with it, to be honest with you, is that unless you use all Enlightenment applications, they're all built on ETK. I mean, I started up Firefox, and Firefox looks shite. It's sitting there in the middle of this quite nice-looking desktop, and it just looked like, you know, some kind of horrible Soviet tower block would look in the middle.
But that's a distributor thing,
you know,
isn't it?
Next to...
You look to a distributor to fix those
kind
of things.
Well, what I'd love to see someone make Ubuntu or eFedora or something.
Ubuntu.
Lancashire Ubuntu.
Lancashire Ubuntu. Luxury.
Yeah, that'd be... If someone said, okay, Enlightenment team, you go ahead and actually make the thing. We're going to now take it and make sure that it comes with a decent default set of applications. And that it... I mean... They've done a very good job of supporting all the standards. My applications menu just appeared in there, fine, and that all worked. And they don't have a system tray, a notification area, because apparently the notification area is... they don't like the way that the standard's been implemented or described. I didn't really get to the bottom of it. But it was an interesting experiment to look at, because I wondered where the hell it had gone. But...
It used
to be famous for being really, really pretty, and now it's famous for being 10 years in the development.
It'll be the GNU herd window manager.
So
as I said, I looked at Enlightenment. I looked at Rasterman's website. One of the things I noticed, as you've already mentioned, is that the Enlightenment window manager and environment has a lot of its own applications.
Yes.
And I wondered, I mean, first of all, I know they're going for a specific goal, but is that reinventing the wheel and therefore leaving them in a position that, say, BIOS is in, where they've got all of their own applications, nobody else uses them, and they're basically, they've missed the boat, and they're slightly obsoleted, or Atheos, or any of these other operating systems, or
I'd love to see that, like I said earlier on, I'd love to see someone like Rasterman join forces with you know, I'd love to see him go to town with some of the other. I mean, obviously it's not just him. Enlightenment developers must get pissed off when you only ever hear about Rasterman, but obviously the other people who are involved in the project, I'd love to see them go to town on GTK and go to town on GNOME.
As I understand it, and I'm reporting rumour here broadly, as I understand it, they have approached the GTK team and said, we'd be interested in doing this and that and the other, and have been rebuffed, but I don't know why. Right. I don't know whether the rebuffing
was reasonable thing for us
or whether they offered it in the wrong way or what. Because the big issue is that, yes, they're writing all their own applications, but if you have applications that aren't based on ETK, they won't do all the cool Enlightenment stuff, so you won't get cool ripply buttons and things. So I'm not sure how you can get around that problem, realistically.
Just as a closing thought, something I've noticed that's related to this is that one thing we seem to do quite well with in the open source world is some of these graphics geniuses. You know, it's like, there's not many of them, but you got people like Rasterman and
Carl Wirth and Zach Rosen.
Yeah, Zach Rosen. And another person who's appeared from, certainly when I was involved in KDE, is a guy called Daniel Dewley, who was MOSFET. MOSFET did...
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah, he's just appeared recently. He's doing loads of graphics hacking. I mean, he wrote, for those who don't know him, he wrote I think it was called Liquid at the time, which was the real nice KDE theme that was kind of translucent. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a little program called Pixie, which was like an image. And he wrote a lot of very optimized image rendering stuff. And he was, you know, he's a real asset to the KDE project. And then he basically vanished. I don't know whether he's cut his hair. He had a terrible haircut. Terrible. I mean, he looked like he looked like my friend's mum. Anyway, but he's appeared again, and he's doing that kind of stuff, and he's a really nice chap, really, really talented graphics developer, and it's really nice to know we've got these, you know, in the same way we've got really talented kernel developers, we've got some really talented graphics developers.
Has he divorced from Bobber and taken on his maiden name, or is he still called MOSFET?
In conclusion, MOSFET. I would like to say, let the Enlightenment team carry on and work towards the goal, the perfection they have in mind, but I'd love to see someone else come in and take Enlightenment and build a distribution from it to demonstrate it to the world. One of the things that the E team complain about quite a bit is that they don't have enough hands on deck. But part of the reason for that is that there's quite a big hurdle to get over to get into it, because you've got to download it all from CVS and compile it and get involved in the project a bit to understand what compiles and what doesn't.
Well, if there's ever a time that can happen, I mean, you know, just the two distros, I mean, obviously I'm involved with distros, but the two distros, you know, of Ubuntu and Fedora, both of those distros make it really easy to roll your own.
I'd love to see someone make a Fedora spin of Enlightenment, or an Ubuntu derivative, or something.
Absolutely.
Sweet spin.
Cool.
emails. Indeed, you sent us emails. Thank you very much.
Yes.
People, again, well done. First one from a guy called Bradley, who says, I was to get my recommended fortnightly allowance of Lug Radio listening to random episodes. Yeah, we know the season, the summer break was quite long. We're sorry about that.
Yeah.
But he says, I ran across something from season one, episode 5.
What?
Long time ago.
1862 when that came out.
Where John and Ack were discussing Debian users, of which I am one, generally rolling their own kernels, as opposed to Mandriva users who just want their modules to work. I was wondering if the growing popularity of Ubuntu has changed the calculus of this. Since Ubuntu has gained so much market share, especially with the opposite kind of demographic of the Debian community, I can see more Ubuntu users not compiling their own kernel. He talks about it a bit more and then says, I'd love to hear the Lug Radio staff's revisit of this topic. First of all, I think we have staff, don't we?
Do we have a company handbook?
We do. We have a mission statement.
Thou shalt not masturbate.
Oh,
that's not good.
Anyway, he'd like to have us very briefly talk about that, and I can't see any reason why not. I mean, I think, to be honest with you, these days, Ubuntu and Fedora users, it's not that they're just not compiling their own kernels. I think half of them barely even know what a kernel is, and good.
It's just, I think a lot of it's just unnecessary now. I used to compile my kernels all the time when I was a Debian and a Slackware user, and it's like nowadays, stuff just works.
Yeah.
I just don't feel the need to do it. Maybe I've become less technical.
I suspect if I was using Debian, I wouldn't compile my own kernel either. Mm. I mean, the fact that you can do is there. And Debian users, because they're more heavily technical, are the sort of people who might want to compile their own kernel for performance or whatever. But you don't actually need to anymore, I don't think.
The only time I tend to compile a kernel is when I'm playing with a piece of hardware and I use it. Like, I had a webcam that... I wanted, you know, it was a pretty buggy kernel
driver.
You were
going to spank the monkey on the web, weren't you?
You can actually go to baconuncovered.org.
Do you two compile kernels?
The last time I compiled a kernel was when I was running Debian, which was, maybe 4 years ago nearly.
Yeah.
Because I had to.
Last one I compiled was trying to get to work on, an iBook, which was... 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, I mean,
weird hardware, basically.
I have compiled a couple of kernel modules.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've not actually compiled a kernel. And even then, I've only compiled those kernel modules because I wanted to use some bleeding edge stuff. I'm sure it'd been there in the next release of whatever I was using.
So there we go.
Fedora or SUSE or Ubuntu or whatever.
So thanks for the email.
Thank you very much, Bradley Alexander. Yeah, I do believe we have changed our views on that, and none of us compile kernels anymore.
Yep, indeed. Things have changed in 3 years.
Woo. I've had an email from David Dolphin entitled, You Fat Laughing Ginger.
Fucking Harry Potter, the Irish version.
Who could that be about, incidentally?
Not sure. It says, I was listening to Lug Radio Season 5, Episode 1 last night, and doing the intro, Ack laughed like a maniac, as he's known to do. His crazy laugh caused my left earphone to pop, and it now crackles with anything louder than 20 decibels at the frequency similar to his laugh.
This is known as gingivitis.
Just let Ack know that his voice is awesome earphone popping power.
Incidentally, he shouldn't be listening to Lug Radio videos because he should Lug Radio because he's too busy editing the fucking video from Skycon, which he never sent us.
I ought to point out, Baconio, we ought not have a problem people about not editing video. Right? Shut up about that.
I never edit videos.
I think is the point.
I'm not supposed to edit videos. Apart from my special private videos.
I think we should just take a moment to pause on two of those points there. First of all, you fat laughing ginger.
I have a laugh that destroys people's earphones. So enjoy that. Everyone who can only hear Lug Radio in their right ear now, well, I'm sorry about that. I'm available for children's parties, though.
Talking about unfortunate Irishmen. that was a beautiful segue, wasn't it?
That was very nice.
I have an email here from Mr. Ken Fallon entitled N800 Does It Exist?
Uh-oh.
Booting the Spuds Bacon. Hi lads, in season 4 there was talk of me winning a Nokia N800. Now, months later, there is no sign of it being delivered.
No.
Did this prize exist or were you actually pulling the urine? Ken.
No, it was actually, a guy when it was called Den Fallon. And he's got his N800 and very happy with it.
No, excuse me, don't you try and dodge this bacon, right?
I made it quite clear in my defence, off air, that I'm not supposed to send stuff out because it never gets sent out.
Send him his N800. He won.
We need to
find it.
For God's sake.
Yeah, because I've got a vault full
like,
of them.
Like, Ken, we're very sorry.
Yeah, we are very sorry.
Well, the three of us are very sorry. Bacon is very guilty and very sorry because yeah. It was his job.
Ken, I'd like to stress, I am very, very sorry because despite protesting, I have been given the luxurious privilege of sending you your N800. You will get it, absolutely, at some point.
Oh. Eventually.
Possibly. No, you will get it. I'll make a point of sending it out, sometime in the next 6 months.
Just to cap that email off, I've also got one here from a Mr. Stuart Langridge, which is entitled, Forward, N800, Does It Exist? And the content of that email is, Find it and send it to him.
Do your job, Bacon. You've now been shooed by email, by phone by me, and live on air.
I believe, Ken, actually, if you just hang on a little longer, you might get it by the time the N900 comes out.
Not encouraging people to win in competitions here, people.
but again, I don't trust me for sending stuff out, but I will send it out at some point, as soon as possible. Email from Derek Weber.
That's my man Weber.
Your man Weber.
Yeah, he's supposed to be pronounced Weber. But I just
does he wobble but
Weber.
Not fall down?
I thought man Weber was some kind of crappy Linux distribution.
No, I was unkind to him in the last episode. I kept calling him Weber instead. He said he's pronounced Weber. He's probably a fucking different guy now, isn't he?
He does wobble, but he doesn't fall down. I got so pissed off when I was a kid because this girl at my school had the Weeble aeroplane.
You kept pushing her and she wouldn't fall over.
She was very
rare. Did you pull her pigtails and expect her to chase you?
That was my uncle dressed up. Howdy, me again. Yeah, I know who he is. He was the guy from PyCon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, hello, Derek.
Is that the lead singer of Europe?
No, that wasn't that guy. Howdy, me again. I hear I'm famous, but I still have to catch up on the first episode of Series 5. Slackballs. I just checked out your website. I like the revamp and especially the gallery. The boy band pics are hilarious. Keep up the good work.
Shut up, not boy quite, band pics.
Not really going for the boy band.
No, not quite what we were hoping for, really.
That was fun, though, the photo shoot.
Yeah, it was.
It was good.
It was. Half the people who've seen the photos have gone, why the hell have you got pictures in Starbucks? Don't do that.
Nearly got arrested that day as well. Accidentally threatened a police officer.
Moving on. I have an email here from Michael Griffin. Email entitled Lug Radio, What Happens with Open Hardware? He says, congratulations on the start of your new season. I was in the UK earlier this year, but unfortunately I had to cancel my plans to attend Lug Radio Live because I was injured by a gang of hooligans in Wolverhampton. I was walking down the street with my newly purchased Neuros OSD TV movie streamer and GP2X handheld games console when I was accosted by four surly thugs in black t-shirts and Doc Martin boots who demanded that I hand over these items to them, saying, we want more free stuff. I turned, I turned and ran down the street to escape them, but they caught up with me and proceeded to put the docks into me with great relish. Why did they want relish? As I lay on the ground bleeding, the four of them loomed over me and prepared to finish me off. However, I was able to pull out my OpenMoco Neo 1973 phone and snap a picture of them, which I sent to an email account in a hope that it could be used to bring these villains to justice.
See, at that point, I discovered this is lies.
This is not actually... I was actually thinking, oh my God, he got mugged. That's
awful. Yeah, when I read that, I was like, oh my goodness.
They satisfied themselves with relieving me of my Neuros OSD, GP2X, and OpenMoco, and then delivering an additional shoeing before departing with their loot. I have attached the photograph of them that I took with my OpenMoco. I'm sure you'll agree they look to be vile and vicious characters. Guess who the photo is of?
Yes, the photo is the image at the top of the new Lug Radio website with us looking hard as nails.
And it's got Lug Radio crossed out and Thug Radio written in. So we just like to say, fuck you, Michael.
Yeah, fuck you. You're just jealous because we're fucking nails.
He does say a problem for the Ubuntu branding team here somewhat. He says, I have a question, though. Where does the name Gusty Gibbon come from? Is the Gibbon Gusty because he talks too much, or is it the result of a large curry and a few pints of lager? No. I think
the unfortunate fact here is you're a fucking Muppet, my friend, and you got it wrong.
On the other hand, I've been gutsy after a large curry and a few pints of lager from time to time, so...
No, that's Gusty.
Both of them.
You're generally gutsy, aren't you?
Shut up.
I hope you're not generally hardy.
Thank you very much, Michael Griffin from Ontario. Thank you for that.
The thing I liked about that email, apart from the fact that it was obviously jokey, but the way he wrote it, I love the way some people are very descriptive in the way they write some of these emails. Top dollar.
Yes, we like receiving this kind of thing.
We do. Thank you very much, good work.
Well, I've had an email from Ed.
The duck? Or 209?
Ed the editor.
209.
No idea. Just
you have
Ed.
10 seconds to read out this email. 9 seconds. Carry on.
He basically says, he's talking about whether servers are easy. He says, please don't advise that servers
And
should...
the cotton is high?
What?
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 Carry on.
Moving on. Yeah. Please don't advise that servers should be easy to set up. The last thing the world needs is more systems like Exchange, which are simple to do, but basically buggy, virus-prone, and generally very nasty. And I think that's a fair point. Exchange is essentially an attempt to make an easy mail server easy to set up, and it sucks.
Doesn't necessarily mean that the aim of making an easy-to-use server is a bad idea. It's just that they fucked it up.
You see, I think people used to say this kind of thing about the desktop as well. You know, computers ought to be a bit hard to use.
Yeah.
And now we've attempted to make it easy for people to use them. And I think people are generally happy with that. I'm sure it could happen with servers as well.
Yeah, we shouldn't try and reduce the number of
rec counts. Essentially is that... because they're easy to set up, they encourage people who don't really know what they're doing to set them up. And because they don't really know what they're doing, they end up with all sorts of security flaws and security holes.
You know... You know what? I think this is going to be a constant point of discussion in season 5.
It is.
Yes. He also wants to point out quickly, there's a website, qmailrocks.org, which has lots of nice how-tos on how to properly set up a
website. Qmail Rocks?
Presumably for Qmail. Yeah, qmailrocks.org.
Excellent. Excellent stuff.
Cool. I've got an email here from Joe Markham. Basically, I think, booting about the Zool applications. And he makes a reasonable point, actually. Lack of knowledge about a subject never stop you guys discussing it. That's why we love you. I'm afraid there are indeed no Crystal Space applications based on Zool, but there are, for example, Miro, formerly known as Democracy Player, Juice Video Player, NView Web Editor, Komodo Developer.
Something I ought to just briefly interrupt there and say, Juice, yes, it's based on Zool. Doesn't run on Linux, though, which rather makes you wonder, well, yeah, okay, what's the point in having cross-platformness?
Right.
Unfortunately, he's not here to answer that one. So, the point I was going to make here was that he says there's a bigger list at such and such and such a website, but actually the key thing that Zool enables is the Firefox and Thunderbird add-ons ecosystem. Without cross-platform, easy-to-code UI mechanism, there wouldn't be nearly as many Firefox and Thunderbird add-ons as there are.
A good point and a bad point. The good point is what he's just said. The bad point is the big list of Zool applications, which no one's really heard of.
Yeah, I mean, Juiced is quite famous, but yeah, and he does make a point. He links to there's a list of them on Mozilla Zine, isn't it?
Yeah. Sorry, yeah. I was zoning.
Yeah, that's cool. But the extensions thing for Thunderbird and especially Firefox is a very good point.
I never cease to be impressed at the range of extensions for Firefox. I don't use Thunderbird, but it's like I've got a little thing called Fox Clocks, which is just puts a little bar above your status bar, and it allows you to add time zones. So, for example, you know, I mean, I've got two people on my team who work in Germany and in the US, in Detroit. And I'm sick and tired of looking up UTC times. I always forget it. And it changes, you know?
I always end up Googling for, like, Portland time.
Yeah. And it's just so useful. So, and there's loads of these little things. And I think that's... Zula's absolutely... We never really covered that, you know? We kind of ignored the extensions
we
thing.
We did, completely.
And that's a really valid point that our good friend, Jerv, Tiny Jerv.
So, yes, it enables Bacon to find out when diagnosis murder is on all over the world.
Shut the fuck up. Final email is from... Harkonnen Shriver, I hope I pronounced that correctly. Great show, best Linux podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
We always like
hearing that we're better than the Linux Action Show.
Incidentally, have you seen that on the Wikipedia article for Lug Radio? There's a section called Rivalry with Linux Action Show.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I love the fact that people mail us
about... We haven't got a rivalry, have we?
Apparently there's a friendly rivalry. We have got there's a friendly rivalry happened in two episodes with Bert and Ernie.
Yeah. Perhaps we ought to stick the boot in a bit. Perhaps we ought to cooperate because we're all friends in the open source community. So well done, Bert and Ernie. You're doing a very good job over the Action Show.
Yeah, you haven't got rapist eyebrows at all. It's all a lie.
I ought to actually say, just
Since we're actually
sticking the boot into other Linux podcasts, I would like to say I think Linux Reality by Chess Griffin is really good. And not only because he sent me an email saying he thinks that Lug Radio is good, but I think he's a really nice guy. Thank you very much, Chess.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Plus, your name is Chess. I mean, how cool is that?
Has he got a brother called Backgammon?
Oh, this is my brother Ludo.
I know.
Game of Life Griffin.
I used to have a dog called Ludo.
Really?
Abo.
Oh, shut up.
Anyway, Harkonnen says, great show, best links podcast. I am an American, and I will attend the Lug Radio Live in San Francisco. Very excited about it. Rather than requesting any sort of concession, even though you haven't said that there will be concessions, which, incidentally, there will be concessions, I would like to request instead that lugradio.org hires me as their consultant so that I can acquire a UK work visa and then move permanently to England to find fame and fortune as a Linux noob. I'll love you long time. Do you have an opening?
Not for you, we don't, Harkonnen.
As you British people say, cheers. Right, so a couple of points here.
Yeah,
firstly, no.
The first one is no. You're aware of the fact that you download this show for nothing, right? When people start paying us, we'll start paying people. As John Leach, who did the t-shirts for Lug Radio Live in the UK, will testify.
there is
an important point to make.
There is an important point about Lug Radio Live. Now, we'll provide a little bit of background here.
Yes.
Lug Radio Live in the US, very excited about it. We announced in the last episode that we're going to be holding it on the 22nd, 23rd of March at the DNA Lounge in San Francisco. We then found out shortly after that there's going to be a under 21s wouldn't be allowed into the DNA Lounge.
Something to do with the liquor licensing laws.
Something to do with Californian law.
Or something.
The governators set some criminal law.
It's not the DNA's fault. It's so, just the way it has to be.
We were thinking about this and we're thinking, on one side, you know, it's probably not going to affect that many people, but on the other side, it sends out the wrong message. Lug Radio has always been about everybody's welcome. It doesn't matter how old you are, what colour your skin is, what your interests are. We try to, where possible, exclude Emacs people, but, you know... kidding! So basically, we made a decision, and we're looking into additional venues. So don't book your plane tickets.
Yes,
for the 22nd, 23rd of March.
Because it might not be then. I mean, we will obviously try and keep it to the same weekend, but because we haven't worked out the venue yet, we don't know exactly when it's going
to be. Just to clarify, it will be in the San Francisco area, and it will be happening. Lug Radio Live in the US will be happening. Absolutely, we just need to. We want to make sure we can get everything that we want, and. Yeah. It will happen in the UK as well, because I know some people still think it's not going to happen in the UK.
It is. It's happening in the UK. So, people in San Francisco, if you're listening to this and you have ideas for venues that you think would be good for Lug Radio Live, we're not looking for the Moscone Center here.
Your house doesn't count.
Somewhere cool, then let us know. I mean, God knows, I would like to do it on Alcatraz, but I don't think they hire us the place. How cool would that? Public Enemy played a gig in Alcatraz.
Yeah, could there's one difference, next. You know. They're Public Enemy, we're not. I'd like to stand on a rock holding a guitar and be filmed, you know? It's not going to happen either.
True enough. Anyway, but yes, so that's the news about Lug Radio Live in the US. It's definitely happening, but we're still trying to confirm a venue.
And you under 21s, best be fucking pleased, incidentally. You know? So, I think we're done. Have we got anything else to announce?
No, I don't think so.
Acklux and Chris.
Oh, yes, there is one other thing. I would say that the music that we used earlier in the show was from Elephant's Dream, used under a Creative Commons Attribution license. So here I am attributing it. Thank you very much, the Elephant's Dream team.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'd also like to say a little thank you to Bytemark Hosting, who we haven't thanked for a while. We've come back with Season 5, and their server is getting hammered as usual. Right, and thanks to the Mirror Network as well for who contributed. And also thanks to... What's Trick's company called?
Line 3 Internet.
Line 3 Internet, who host the forums.
Who host our forums. That's forums.lugradio.org if you're interested in...
Go there and be part of the community.
Absolutely. Ding, 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 ding. Bacon's in community.
Well, you know.
But yes, be part of it.
show@lugradio.org, send your email there. Yep, so I think we're done.
I think we can wrap up there.
Oh, there is one other thing. If you very, very, very briefly, we have our voicemail number back up again. I can't remember what it is off the top of my head, but if you look at lugradio.org/contact, we've actually written it down this time.
And go to the new lugradio.org, and if you want us to come and do a live show, you can find instructions by clicking on the live link.
So I think we're all done, finally now.
All done, finally.
One more thing. No.
Thank you, and goodbye.
Good night.
Bye-bye.